This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
So, Jason, today's show, sadly, marks the end of season two of Candidate Confessional.
It's the hardest part of being a podcast host.
It's but, calling an end to a season.
I thought, to mark the occasion, what better way to close things out than to bring back one of our favorite guests from season one?
Oh my God, where is he? Where's Boo Ben-Kanop?
It's not Boo Ben-Kanop.
Love him.
You know it's not Boo Ben-Kanop. Now, in recent episodes, we've been looking back to previous political eras. But today, we're shifting gears a bit. In a way, today's episode is about the future of politics in the age of Donald Trump. And for that purpose, we're going to take a look at one very recent election. Now, the 2016 presidential election left us relatively adrift in the sea of political uncertainty. There was Trump's win. There was the Clinton-Sanders primary. And then there's pretty much everything that's happened since January 20th. Many of the assumptions that we held about what voters actually want seem to have been upended. And in the search for answers, we inevitably reduce every subsequent election into a simplistic frame.
The Georgia special election was viewed by many as a referendum on President Trump.
Political experts have suggested the race could be a referendum on the Trump presidency.
And they considered it a referendum for President Trump.
Referendum on President
Trump. Referendum on President Trump.
Of course, not every contest can be made about Trump.
No.
Especially, for example, if it's between Democrats.
One of the races to pay attention to is the race for governor of Virginia, where former Congressman Tom Perriello is challenging the current Lieutenant Governor Ralph Northam in the Democratic primary.
Longtime fans of the show may remember that we interviewed Tom Perriello for season one. He won a seat in Congress during the Obama wave of 2008, and over the next 2 years, as swing state Democrats deserted the president, Perriello vigorously defended the Obama agenda. He kept the 2010 race close, but ultimately fell short.
Perriello was swept out of office in the Tea Party wave of 2010.
Now, after a few years at the Center for American Progress and working as a diplomat in Africa, Perriello decided to try his hand in Virginia electoral politics once more. So early this year, he challenged the state's lieutenant governor, Ralph Northam, in the Democratic gubernatorial primary. Now, Perriello is pretty solidly on the economic left, and he had the support of Senator Bernie Sanders, so we in the news media quickly found a very tidy template to analyze this race. It was Bernie versus the establishment all over again.
A narrative has taken shape. Tom Perriello is the fiery voice of the Trump resistance, backed by Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren.
Northam has the backing of most of the party's establishment, but Perriello was endorsed by Senator Bernie Sanders.
So what does Tom himself think of this particular trope?
I think it's a pretty lazy framework. First of all, I think both of them are historic figures. Hillary Clinton has been a groundbreaking diplomat around the world. Bernie Sanders inspired a movement to address inequality and corruption. We would love for our campaign to be worthy of both of those traditions.
He's not totally wrong, of course. That said, the issues that Perriello tried to bring to the fore were the same ones that the Democratic Party is currently having a major internal struggle over. Most centrally, how our political system should adjust to a changing economy rocked by things like globalization and, more importantly, automation. Now, Perriello lost to Northam, but his run still revealed lessons for Democrats, mainly how the party needs to completely upend its thinking, its policies, and its general approach to thrive in the age of Trump. This is Candidate Confessional. Tom Perriello, thank you for joining us.
I when people ask why I ran for governor this year, I say so that I could lose and be on this podcast again. That was really
motivation. an inspiration to all.
It's a great way to, you know, make money. It's lucrative.
I'm donating 100% of my proceeds from this podcast.
I'm sorry to all the charities who will get nothing.
So I guess half the Dr. Pepper he's drinking.
That's true. Yeah. The Diet Dr. Pepper.
So let's why don't we start at the beginning? Why run at all?
You know, I felt...
let me stop right there. You ran, because no one... We just got to make sure. You ran for the Democratic nominee, to be not Democratic nominee in the Virginia gubernatorial race in 2017. So why run at all?
You were away from Virginia for a while, too. So if you want to kind of... Yeah. You were looking to that as sort of almost as an observer through 2016.
Yeah, I'd been, you know, Hatch Act limited because I was working for the Obama administration, so I couldn't be involved in politics. I was living in Alexandria and, you know, frankly, as I talked about on the trail, you know, a huge number of the workers that were affected by the Quadrennial Diplomacy and Development Review were actually in Northern Virginia. And we were looking at even issues like transportation, frankly, as a national security challenge because we have such a disastrous infrastructure in Northern Virginia, and it affects everything from quality of life, our ability to recruit people in. So, you know, there was a lot of engagement in Virginia, but not necessarily in the traditional political context. But as someone who has worked in countries with authoritarians and with racial demagogues, I had a very strong sense on election night that this was not a transfer of power from Democrats to Republicans. This was something new that we had not seen. Not only had he run what I considered the most viciously racist campaign of my lifetime, but this was someone where there was kind of a deeper set of tendencies there that were problematic, and I knew that my state of Virginia was going to be the first place to genuinely have a showdown about that. But I also had a sense, and I think this was part of what really animated our campaign, that it was very important for Democrats not just to address Trump, but the forces that gave rise to Trump in the first place. Because it's very important to understand he's not a leader. He's just not – like he's a manipulator and rider of trends. He doesn't actually have the gravitas or brain wave to actually create a trend. And as I've talked about before here and elsewhere – 5 or 6 years ago, I became convinced that the probabilities of a world war have increased dramatically in the last 10 years. And it's a collision course of two forces that essentially, in my mind, predicted the rise of Trump. One has been the disappearance of work and resulting skyrocketing of both debt and radical inequality across the world. And the second has been the resurgence of structural and overt racism as a political strategy. It's never gone away. So we had this, you know, we're starting to have this debate after the election. Was Trump's election about economic anxiety or about racism? And my answer is yes. These two things have always gone hand in hand and reinforced each other. And Trump understood that and was able to play on that trend. So if we don't admit the structural and overt racism part, we're not doing our job as progressives. But if we then get reductionist and say, therefore, all of these voters out there are just about racism and there is no economic problem, we are losing touch not just with Trump voters, but actually with the vast majority of our own coalition that is struggling economically. And that was what was exciting on the campaign trail was that an enormous number of the things that we were doing that actually excited our coalition outside the inner ring suburbs was also stuff that played well in Trump country. And so I think we were developing some really exciting policy and vision pieces that can be part of that path forward. It's just going to take a politician more talented than me.
Probably the most uplifting first response to a question. World War III, racism, inequality.
So, what made you
my fun material the first time around. Now you get to Armageddon.
So,
Tom.
Did you really actually just decide on election night that you wanted to run, or had you been thinking about jumping back into electoral politics prior to election?
No, it was a real conversion experience that night. I mean, I had been excited for different reasons.
What were you doing then? Tell us, where were you that night? How you processed the returns? I mean, a lot of people were shocked by it. I'm assuming you were one of them.
You know, I kind of went back and forth. I felt during a lot of last year that people were underestimating Trump's chances. At the same time, there was still that part of me that just didn't want to believe that it was possible. So in that, you know, Saturday Night Live skit with Chris Rock, I'd say I was half with, you know, the people on the couch and half with the people standing up. I think that the, right now, what had been very hopeful in the last few years, which also had made me think about politics again, was that I've always believed that movements change the world and politicians show up to take the credit for it.
Sure.
And during most of my lifetime, we haven't had very strong progressive movements, with a few exceptions, obviously the LGBT movement and a few others. But in recent years, you've really seen an emergence or kind of a growing up evolution of multiple movements, obviously the immigration dignity and rights movement, the inequality movement, the Black Lives Matter movement, and others. And I felt like it was creating space for a different generation of politicians to come in and work with that, because I used to believe politicians don't matter. Now I believe it's a partnership. It's the job of movements to change our sense of what's possible. It's the job of politicians to work within the sense of what's possible. But the difference between getting, you know, an LBJ who's willing to push that envelope and, frankly, JFK who gets too much credit, who tended to take a more narrow view, is the difference between great leaps forward or great moments of progress and social change. And this appeared to me to be one of those. Initially, I was feeling on the optimistic side. Now it's not back in the other direction. But that's also part of movement history, which is actually the Nixons of the world have been, and I think Trump knew this, the more dystopian play on racism have tended to respond to actual racial progress. And that wasn't just Obama's election that people get focused on. I think it was as much to do with the movement for Black Lives and the willingness to actually start talking about genuinely valuing lives, looking at the DOJ, poking into some of these issues.
So you recognized Trump's opening pretty early on, it seems like. I mean, you didn't think he would win, but you saw that there was a
And I thought it would actually happen in Europe before it happened in the U.S. So when I play out the World War scenarios, there are like seven different scenarios. But the rise of sort of white nationalism had a few different places it could play out. Unfortunately, we won that race.
Congrats.
He is like a risk board at home.
Yeah, I was going to say. We gave him this. All right,
but what about Trump's connection to rural voters that you think you could challenge in a sort of practical way?
So –
I mean, right now you're thinking. I'm thinking of you as running for like the head of Brookings. So now you're in. Now you're in.
This is exactly the myth I want to explode. So first thing that's worth noting is we won rural parts of Virginia by 60 or 70 points.
Yeah.
And the number of days that I spent having conversations in rural Virginia where people brought up to me what I'm about to talk about, issues like monopoly and issues like automation. And then I would end the day inside the Beltway with people saying, oh, you can't talk like that to those people. You sound like a think tank. Well, you know what? People are pretty damn smart. Yeah. And they know that automation's a problem because it's already killed more coal jobs than natural gas has. This is something that is already a lived reality, both for a lot of communities of color and urban areas and rural white voters. And so, you know, the theory was, and we went out and tested this and it worked. You know, I would say often, look, I agree that Trump gets half right. We've lost 5.7 million manufacturing jobs in the last 10 years. Can anyone in this room tell me where 85% of them went? And when I'm in Trump country, every hand goes up and they say computers and technology. When I do the same question up here, I'm actually more likely to get other answers.
China, Mexico,
right.
NAFTA.
And so the idea of going in to communities and validating the parts of their lived experience that we want to validate and then speaking to that is a game changer. We talked a lot about monopoly in this race because basically if you look at the Clinton recovery in the 90s, you know, 73% of new businesses were created in small and medium-sized towns. If you look at this recent recovery, 80% plus was in the big cities.
Yeah.
0% in small towns and counties. So this is not some myth that Trump voters are too dumb to realize what's going on economically. They're actually 10 steps ahead of where we are. Now, that doesn't mean that racism wasn't also an issue, though I actually think Trump used racism more effectively with the white suburbs than he did with white rural communities. So when you go out, you know, I think part of my background, as you know, is that I've spent more time as a peace negotiator than as a politician. And one of the things you do as a peace negotiator, of course, is you go out and listen a lot and you try to find common ground between people who've literally been killing each other. You don't have to reach full agreement, but you try to build off that common ground. And I can't tell you how many days I would start in a blue part of the state and particularly say in the African-American community and have people say, hey, whatever happened to the trade schools and the apprenticeship programs and community college pathways into trades in the working class? And then I'd be out in one of the reddest parts of the state and they would say, you know, whatever happened to the trade schools and the apprenticeship programs? And then they'd say, you know, we really need to take mental health more seriously and we need to start treating addiction as a health crisis and not a criminal crisis. And then you'd be back in the blue part and you'd hear the same thing. And none of those, frankly, are issues that are going to come up at the top of the list at a Democratic fundraising event.
Why is that? Why wouldn't it come up as a top issue?
If I bring it up, there's a lot of support for it. But it's not the first – it's not in the forebrain of the lived experience of people that can write a $1,000 check.
It sounds like in some ways you saw your bid for governor not just as a chance to be governor but a chance to sort of revamp how Democrats operate electorally. I'm not saying that you had like this huge mission, but maybe you thought, but maybe you did. Maybe did you when you jumped into the race? Did you think, okay, this is an opportunity not just to win, but an opportunity to give a template for Democrats about how to talk to Trump voters?
I would frame it differently, but sure. It gets partly to the same place. My goal was to actually govern.
Okay, fair enough.
I wasn't that interested in having the title of governor. I was interested in what I could accomplish as governor. And so we were trying to run the race in a way that would actually maximize my ability to get things done when I was in Richmond. And that in part is going to require changing the political map across the state, partly because of the gerrymandering. This is what many, including I think the Washington Post Ed Board, just completely get wrong about how politics works today. I think what we were doing is actually building a significant political base in parts of the state that would then make it easier for me to work with those legislators, not because I'd gone and hugged it out with them. That approach stopped working in the 90s, right? If that worked, then Barack Obama would have gotten bipartisan support everything he supported. It's about going out and actually changing that political foundation. So I wanted to win, but I also wanted to win with a coalition that would allow me to actually get things done that could reduce human suffering and increase human flourishing. Now, obviously, the hope was if we did that, Podesta called our race the blueprint for the future of the Democratic Party, no pressure. And so, yes, I mean, we understood that this was in part hopefully something others could learn from. And I think even in a loss, you know, the groups we did well with are the groups Democrats are struggling with. Young voters, voters of color below the age of 65, and rural voters.
What did you – as you went out and did this, as you were trying to build the blueprint for the 21st century Democrat, what did you discover about the Democratic Party that maybe was different from your last run in 2010? How has the party evolved since you were last in election?
Or Virginia.
Or just Virginia itself.
Yeah. Well, first, 10 years ago, Facebook was how you reach young voters, and now Facebook is how you reach seniors. So, you know, there are
that's
some
true. God, that
you got to go snap.
Camp
you got snap.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's hey, reaching seniors is important.
Sure.
Party's changed a lot, and it's really exciting. I mean, you know, we've joked about it a little bit, but when we got in this race, the question was, could a nominee in Virginia win the nomination after standing for a $15 an hour minimum wage, 2 years of community college, and a comprehensive criminal justice reform package? And the answer is yes, because that's – you know, Northam ran on that. Now, we think we pushed the debate in those ways by introducing a lot of issues that had been considered untouchable by Democrats in Virginia and elsewhere a decade ago. And I think this is what – to me, it means to get out of the 1990s mindset. There are a lot of things we think about when we talk about the 1990s approach to politics, triangulation, a lot of the other pieces. But I think underneath it all, to me, is the question about whether we think the economy is fundamentally working and we just need to tweak it around the edges for those people who've been marginalized or left out, or whether we think that there's something actually not working in the economy. And I think this is the difference, for example, between the old approach of saying let's have a $2,000 tax credit for college affordability or saying we're going to make 2 years of community college free and you know move towards potentially 4 years of free university education. That's a difference of understanding generationally that the opportunities that existed before just don't exist. But I think our willingness to talk about criminal justice reform, we also put out a paper that hadn't been done before on the racial wealth gap in Virginia, talked in some very blunt terms connecting the dots because I think one of the things that is very important across the country but particularly in the former capital of the Confederacy is we have this tendency in our history to kind of jump from slavery to today with a brief stop in Jim Crow. And it's really important to understand the Reconstruction period and lynching, sure. To understand Woodrow Wilson firing African Americans from the federal workforce, GI Bill exclusions, redlining. Each generation there's been a ticket to the middle class that's been marked no admittance for the African American community. So talking about that process is very important.
And you weren't having these conversations in 2010, 2009 or – they were just different conversations.
I think we were able or willing to have a much more blunt conversation and talk about privilege, including white privilege, which I was very blunt about in the campaign, and still did well in rural communities. So I think there's this sense that we have to do one or the other. It's not easy, and I'm the first to admit I lost the primary, and it would have been exciting to test this in the general.
But you wouldn't have been on the show.
So correct. The trade-offs are.
That's why he lost. But did you get a sense of differences in just in the voters, like the voters that you were meeting and talking to in 2010 versus who you were meeting now? What were their issues then, and what were their issues now? What are their concerns?
Look, I mean, some things have changed. In 2010, my vote for Obamacare was a political liability, and in this, it was a political asset. And I think
even in the rural parts.
Yeah. I mean, again –
you didn't really say that with conviction.
Well, I'm only because I didn't test in a general election. Like that's it was true. Great for me in the rural areas in a primary, but I want to be honest about what we were able to test. My sense was there that actually the Medicaid expansion – one of the mistakes that we make, particularly up in Northern Virginia, is to assume that these right-wing legislators in Richmond – actually represent the constituents in their communities. If you go to Southwest Virginia, people are much more pragmatic about healthcare. You have people who can literally look across the border into Kentucky and see cousins who have the Medicaid expansion, and they're saying, why the hell don't we have that here? We had an entire hospital shut down that almost certainly would have stayed open if the Medicaid expansion was there. That's a huge amount of jobs. That's education. So I think the way you get the Medicaid expansion through, and we talked about this, and this comes back to the peace negotiating background, is you don't win that fight in Richmond. You win it in Wise County. You win it in Lee County, and you go out and make the case about these things. And that's what we're going to keep doing. So I do think that the argument there is strong. I think and we talked about this. I mean, attitudes toward criminal justice reform have changed a lot. And I was again tried to be very blunt about this on the campaign. Is it a shame that that's only happening now that it's hitting whiter, more conservative communities that we're changing the conversation? Yes, but are we going to miss that convergence to actually not get an opportunity to reduce human suffering? No. And so I think on this whole question about how do we both reach out in rural communities but not sell out our base, I think some of that is to both engage on something like the opioid epidemic, because as progressives, what does it mean if we're not doing that when 3 Virginians die every day of the opioid crisis? On the other hand, to do that and act like while Jeff Sessions is still sitting in power talking entirely differently about urban thugs versus those in the opioid epidemic, we have to call that out for what it is.
Well, did anybody sort of challenge you? What were some of the voters that you weren't winning over, and what were they saying to you? You talked a lot about that the last time you were on, just sort of having to convince people to maybe change their industry, change how they do farming, change how their local economy is, and that's difficult. I'm wondering if you had those challenges again.
Well, first of all, one of the challenges I had in the primary was that I was up against a really nice guy who had been very involved in politics full time for the last few years, and to his credit, I think had built a lot of relationships and had been part of some very important fights, particularly on reproductive rights and a few other things. So, in terms of the primary, I think that's a good problem to have when you have two good Democrats that are fighting it out.
It would be easier if Ralph was a dick, basically.
I think that's from a purely tactical standpoint. Yeah, and so I think that in terms of though trying to expand the party in these ways, we have a couple of challenges. One is, the first order challenge in a state election is getting the people that already support us to care enough to show up. Mm-hmm. And my theory on that has been that voters are actually a lot smarter and more sophisticated than we think. Not just them being too dumb to know the election's going on. They have a pretty good radar on whether it's worth their time. And the example that came up over and over and over again would be some version I'd meet every week of a woman who's working minimum wage. Nearly 2/3 of minimum wage workers in Virginia are women, not coincidentally. We systematically undervalue the work women do, particularly women of color. In Virginia, we have the federal minimum wage. So that woman working full-time makes $14,000 a year. To go back to your question about what's interesting at Democratic fundraisers, I always talk about it as $14,000 a year, not $725. And the level of shock in those rooms when people do the equation and realize that's how much people are living on in Northern Virginia is shocking. And what's the most typical thing that one of those women on minimum wage does after their job is done? They get on a bus to a second minimum wage job.
Yeah.
So every week I would meet women who are working 80 plus hours a week for less than $30,000 a year. And I remember this one woman, but there were many, again, similar. And I said, you know, what do you want from your next Virginia governor? And she said, I'd really like to see my kids awake once a week. If I made a little bit more per hour, I could get home in time to see them. Now, she's not going to vote for Ed Gillespie. The question is whether she's going to vote. And I think that she is making a pretty sophisticated analysis that on an 85-hour week where she commutes another 12 hours a week to be able to get to a community she can afford to live in with schools that she wants to have her kids in, is she going to take 45 minutes to vote? And this, I think, is where Democrats need to understand when we stand for a living wage and don't just check a box on it. When we're speaking about it passionately with the idea we're going to fight about it, we do the same on breaking the school-to-prison pipeline and other things. People do respond to policy, not policy in terms of a policy paper, but whether they hear someone talking about an issue with a level of passion. And again, there are politicians far better at this than I, which is probably why I'm on your show twice. But I think people do respond and make that decision about whether to turn out. And so first group we have to do is get the coalition that already exists in Virginia to turn out. Second group, you actually had 7% of voters last year go third party. Most of them were McMullen-Johnson voters, not Stein voters in Virginia. So you have a group of people that were willing to take one step away from the hate and bigotry and now incompetence of the Republican leadership, but not yet sold on us. That's a group that you reach differently. And then within the Trump voters, you have very different groups. I mean, you know, if someone's primarily voted by motivated by hate or primarily motivated by being anti-choice, frankly, there's not a lot of engagement to be done there. It's the only thing Trump's really delivered on, right, is the anti-choice agenda. And so, you know, it's not about winning every one of those voters, but there are some people in that group that we can reach as well.
I mean, this is – I don't want to oversimplify a little bit, but this was sort of what the Clinton campaign was grappling with in the lead up to 2016, which is – is there a universe within traditional Republican voters who will be so repulsed by Donald Trump that they will actively go against their traditional voting patterns and vote Democratic? And they essentially said, yes, they're going to be in the suburbs. They're going to probably be wealthy and white and educated. Educated was the big key. And they spent a lot of time trying to get those voters. And you can make the argument that John Ossoff did had a similar calculation, or at least the Democratic Party did for John Ossoff, which is this is an incredibly educated district of people who are disaffected by the Republican Party and they will come out and vote Democratic. And it didn't work either time. Why didn't it work?
So let me throw out a theory I can't prove.
Sure. That's why it's a theory.
Everything up until this point is absolutely objectively verifiable. When I said earlier that I think in some ways Trump's racism or race baiting played more in the suburbs, it was actually with college-educated whites. For rural white communities, that dog whistling's been going on forever. But when Trump talked about political correctness, he's playing on some notion. There are a lot of folks, you know,
well, Trump would go around to the suburbs to talk about how shitty the cities were.
Yeah.
So he'd be talking about Chicago mm-hmm. in the Philly suburbs.
And to go back to
also – and he would also say, what do you have to lose as if
– And he was literally quoting Nixon in his speech. So anyways,
yes. It's established that he did this in the suburbs.
And so the you know, it's also where you see diaspora communities growing. And a lot of those white families in those areas haven't gotten a raise in 10 or 15 years. They haven't actually made it to the country club yet, and they're working pretty hard to get there. And the easiest thing to think is, well, that's because the woman or the minority got the promotion at work. And I think he's playing both on the dystopian law and order piece, but also on the you haven't made it quite as far as you thought you would at this point. Let me give you a reason why. So I think that the physical the idea of repulsion to Trump will probably be a little bit more effective on some level for Democrats, given that Hillary Clinton, for lots of unfair reasons, was not trusted by a lot of people. Also, I think with Trump, there was a little bit in, before he was actually president of, hey, maybe he's just crazy enough to work. And I think those people have, you know, have come around to saying maybe not. The problem, though, and I think this is a challenge we'll see in Virginia and elsewhere, is I don't think that people are blaming Republicans. The idea of running against every Republican as a proxy for Trump, I think, is going to be less effective than a lot of Democrat consultants think.
You better tell Ralph. When I talked to Ralph Northam, the governor, the gubernatorial candidate,
future governor,
according to you, I mean, a lot of his shtick was that Ed Gillespie will not stand in the way of the Trump agenda, that Ed Gillespie will facilitate it. And I mean, I think it's fair to say that the ad Ralph ran, calling Trump a narcissistic maniac, broke through perhaps more than anything else from a national perspective in your race. So while Ralph does have his own agenda and while he was pushed in a progressive way by you, I don't think it's a stretch to say that he is being defined to a certain degree as anti-Trump. And is that a problem?
Well, let me be clear. I think we are right to criticize Trump. I think it is something that is both called for from a moral and political perspective, and I think something that will motivate our voters to understand why this matters. I think the question is, do you put all of your chips in that basket, eggs in that basket, I guess? And I don't think Ralph's doing that. I think that, you know, standing up for a living wage and debt-free community college and, you know, the Medicaid expansion and other things are an important part of that. I think there's also a difference in Gillespie's case between trying to suggest Ed Gillespie is the same as Donald Trump versus trying to say that Ed Gillespie is so corrupt and morally weak that he has not been willing to stand up to Donald Trump a single time. And even that difference, I think, is meaningful because people look at Ed Gillespie and they don't see Donald Trump.
Well, do you think there's like a trap? It seems like you're saying there's a broader trap for Democrats in general in the age of Trump, which is he's such a lovely target that you can get lost.
Well, I think that the American people don't actually necessarily see Trump as a Republican because he ran bashing so many of the Republican leaders and does so on a regular basis, and he takes positions that aren't necessarily within Republican orthodoxy. And so I think that he's sort of his own brand. In fact, that's the only thing he's ever really created is his own brand, right? And so people see it there. So and he has such a specific and batshit crazy temperament. Sorry.
It's okay.
Such his own temperament.
Was there moments in the campaign where you were a little rusty? I mean, you hadn't campaigned in a while. Was it tough to sort of modulate from your sort of time, you know, in diplomacy to coming back to Virginians and sort of connecting with voters? How did you connect to the woman that would come up to you who's working those two jobs? And were there moments where you were rusty?
I mean, look, we made lots of mistakes. I'm a flawed candidate in lots of ways.
What were the mistakes? This is the 60 Minutes portion of the
Are you
going to
cry?
I feel like you're
crying.
I'm starting to sweat a little bit.
Yeah, no, it's warm in here, guys. Yeah. Seriously.
Crank the heat up.
Can I get some water in here? From the beginning, basically, we felt like our path to victory was going to require either becoming kind of the Netroots darling or pulling the establishment a little bit more to neutral. Yeah. And, you know, our internals, which ended up being accurate, suggest we were actually up a point with 10 days left. And there was a 15-point swing of undecideds at the end, which a number of things drove that, the Washington Post endorsement, the cumulative economic effect. So if any point in there we had either, you know, been able to accomplish one of those goals, we would have gotten there. And if I was a better candidate, I would have been able to do that. At the beginning, I think, you know, there's a lot we could have done from making more phone calls and doing some relationship management there to being able to better articulate the case of why this was a meaningful difference because there was a national tendency not to get involved in primaries, et cetera. I mean, if we'd had 5% of the OSF money, it would have been a game changer for us. There's no question about it. And, you know, I have my questions about whether putting, you know, if you're at a poker table, do you put $1 million bet in to win a $200,000 dollar pot? Probably not. But
no, you wouldn't do that. That'd be a mistake.
But again, you know, that's on me to not have made the case to people effectively. But the other was national media. Like we had hoped that this we could nationalize the race, and we did with sort of the thought press. There were a lot of written profiles that went through, but we were always the next story up on like the Hayes-Maddow set, right? And Trump just choked out so much of that space.
I know it seems like a really stupid, trivial question, but do you wish you had done the narcissistic maniac ad?
I mean, look, first of all, I wish I had the money to run 4 ads. People were able at the end of the day to see 4 or 5 of Northam's ads and basically 1.5 of ours.
Yeah, but that's not my question is more geared towards do you wish you had been the guy who was like, you know what, I'm going to go there with Trump.
Or would you have gone further like, fuck this guy?
I mean, but the truth is you just sat here. The first thing you said to us when you sat here was you recognized the moment Trump was elected – the authoritarian dictator impulse from your time overseas. I mean, that's brutal stuff. Wait, let's not hold on a second. Let's not like joke around. That's brutal stuff.
And we said all that in the launch video. Okay. Like, I was not in any way. The only issue is I mean, to be honest, that most of the State Democratic Party had not actually even spoken about Trump between Election Day and us getting in the race, and we were criticized initially for coming out and saying we're going to be a firewall against the hate and bigotry of the Trump administration in our launch video January 5th. And the initial buzz was Perriello doesn't understand Virginia, this is not a local issue, et cetera. And like a lot of things in the race, that then ended up getting picked up by others and perhaps escalated by others. So we were very blunt about that. The narcissistic maniac line was a good line, and they had a lot of money to put behind it. What was frustrating was that groups that if you go to the Washington Post editorial board, they were still trying to buy into this frame they had introduced from early on that I was running a purely anti-Trump campaign and Ralph was running a Virginia-based campaign, when if you look at our ads –
And you had pushed Ralph on all these issues too, which is
– I mean, we put out 15 policy papers that the Post wasn't covering and then says, why aren't you doing more Virginia policy? So it's frustrating when those who should be the ones kind of elevating the public debate are kind of playing into the worst of our lowbrow politics. But in terms of the tactics of it, there's no question that the anti-Trump mood was there. We were getting hit for, again, from the media for running a purely anti-Trump campaign despite the fact that we were putting out policy paper after policy – and not just putting them out. We were like going out in the community and doing hour-long –
I thought the frustration you would have actually would be slightly different, which is that there was this prism that people were viewing the race through, which was, oh, this is like Sanders versus Hillary and Ralph's Hillary and you're Sanders. And it was very simplistic, and I thought that might have been a frustration for you.
Yes. There were two or three frames that people understood, and I think journalists, no offense, are pretty lazy and default to clickbait. And replay of 16 is something people understand.
Cut the show. We're done.
We're done.
and some of the more thought journalists got it. I mean, it's if you're endorsed by the chair of Hillary Clinton's campaign, by 30 of Obama's top advisors, and by Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, you can either cover that as, oh, this is about Bernie versus Hillary, or you can say, hey, wait a second, what is this next generation of politics that combines all of these elements?
So you saw your race as more generational then?
Yeah. But again, I got to go convince the voters of that, and voters went the other way, and that's why I'm excited to support.
But didn't none of that really matter? Didn't it come down to the fact that you jumped in the race kind of late, and that Northam had already sewn up the main Democratic people in the state? All the major politicians endorsed him, including Tim Kaine.
Yeah, there were lots of factors, and so that's why it was considered a long shot bid when we got in. I think the fact that we seemed to keep it so close for so long I'd like to think of as a testament to the kind of race we won and run and the rest. You can look at it a lot of ways. I mean, it wasn't just getting in January. It was getting in January from a dead start, right? If I was the sitting congressman at that point and had been doing events all around the state, that's a very different reality to get into. But I really believed in what we were doing. I believed we could change the politics of the state and that we would have put the House of Delegates strongly in play because of the places we were connecting with voters that don't normally look at Democrats or show up in state elections. We went for it.
Why didn't you think you did better in Northern Virginia and Richmond? Those were the places where you didn't do as well.
Yeah, it was interesting. We actually ended up basically drawing even in the exurbs where we thought we would not do as well and getting crushed in the inner-ring suburbs.
And you live in Alexandria, so basically your neighbors voted against you.
Yeah. No, I think –
you look at them differently.
Those who know you best.
Yeah.
Do you look at them differently?
You think they're moving?
No. Though certainly the highest turnout precinct in the state was Charlottesville, where I'm from originally.
There you go.
So, maybe it's to know me and then have absence from me.
Yeah,
as a combination.
That's it. The distance makes the heart.
That works well. Different theories on that. I mean, I think certainly in the inner ring is you can map a theory on it that says we did well in direct proportion to how well people are doing economically, and the Democrats would do well to understand that the exurbs are actually have a lot of families that are cash poor and struggling. So the issue, the bolder economic agenda we are putting out there. But the problem with that is what you brought up earlier. Like, we don't want to overdetermine too much from our race, positive or negative, because you had these various things. You had the unity of the establishment against us. You had the late entry into the race, and you had a $4 million effectively cash advantage.
Well, let's extrapolate from there. What is the what,
extrapolate?
What's the? I hope I used the right word. What is the? What lessons can be learned from other Democrats from your run?
I mean, I probably need a night's sleep before.
You've had many night's sleeps.
We gave you like an extra week.
You were supposed to come on 3 days ago.
I haven't actually. You know, you got to do the unity tour. You got to do the thank
fair
you
enough,
tour.
Enough,
you
got
to launch the new thing to help win back the House of Delegates.
Do you want me to rephrase the question?
No.
So behind the scenes, Ralph, he's kind of a dick, right? He's a total
very,
dick.
Very good man. And
no, seriously.
Be a great governor.
What
do we learn from this?
How about this? What's the biggest thing Democrats should worry about going into this next cycle?
I think one is that we are going to miss a generational opportunity if we just assume anti-Trump energy is pro-Democratic Party energy. We have to go out and make the case. We have to earn that. And there are a lot of voters out there that are not sold on the Democratic Party. I think that's one. The second, and I think that the real medium to long-term play in my mind is whichever party figures out how to talk about both monopoly and automation first is going to define the politics of the next 10 to 15 years. I think that needs to be done along with blunt conversation about structural and overt racism rather than at odds with it. And you know, the only thing in my mind right now dumber than the false fight between whether this was about economic anxiety or racism is this public intellectual fight between the monopoly crowd and the automation crowd who hate each other. And both of these are huge problems that reinforce each other. I think there is tremendous resonance out there. I mean, monopolies, you know, the only group that hates monopolies more than progressives are conservatives. And this is crushing communities, you know, and there's a lot that we can speak to in this space. So the starting point here is I think that politicians from both parties for the most part don't want to talk about these two topics because no one has a solution to these two topics and because they don't make a good bogeyman. Monopolies a little bit. Automation, not at all.
Monopolies make a very good
– Monopolies do. And so – but with the automation crowd, I mean we're talking about literally half of jobs in Virginia that could be disrupted or destroyed in the next 15 years. Mm-hmm. I think AI and deep learning is going to come on sooner than people think. I think people can already feel it in their jobs. I think the data is hiding a lot of the impacts that are already there. And I always come back to this idea that we have to remember that voters are smarter than we think. So they can see what's happening to the toll booth collector, the ATM collector. And when what they hear, I think Democrats have a higher price to pay for not dealing with this because most voters think Silicon Valley is driven by Democrats, which isn't in fact true. And they think technology is coming out of the big cities that vote for Democrats, which is true. And so I think their default assumption is going to be that this is, you know, driven there. And that's partly because Republicans are more comfortable being intellectually dishonest so they can keep blaming, you know, outsourcing or whatever else.
So you might run again, but let's say you instead are, you know, tasked by John Podesta to help actually deliver that blueprint for the 21st century Democrat. What's your top three suggestions?
I think that one of the things that I try to talk about on the trail that I think can be part of this, I said the answer to some of our problems is beer.
Beer.
And so
I like that.
Okay. It's not just because the president drives us to drink more, and alcohol sales would suggest that. But 15 years ago, 96% of all the beer we drank in America was produced by a couple of big beer companies. You've seen the explosion of
microbrews.
It's completely destroyed big beer, so now they only control 85% of all the beer that we drink in America. That 11% delta has radically transformed a lot of main streets and rural communities around Virginia. If we looked at even a 10 to 15% relocalization on food, on ag, including industrial hemp, medicinal marijuana, and other products, and looked at energy, which is the holy grail, if you went to 30 to 50% localized energy production, you would actually solve the jobs crisis. You would solve the rural economic development crisis. And here in Virginia, almost in Virginia, you know, we have this thing going on right now where the people in Northern Virginia feel like they pay all the taxes to the rest of the state and get nothing but vitriol in return. The rest of the state feels like all the jobs and growth are up in Northern Virginia and they're being left behind. Both of these narratives are actually true. And the answer to that is, what if we could actually be doing massive economic redevelopment in these areas, switching from an economy of extraction to an economy of restoration in a way that helps then produce tax revenue, et cetera, and take the pressure off Northern Virginia while addressing climate change, et cetera. With the pipeline fights we were involved in Virginia, yes, I oppose them because of the climate implications. I was absolutely clear about that. Everyone in rural Virginia knows I'm a climate hawk. I voted for the cap and trade bill and I went home and defended it. But the bigger play here is actually about whether or not you want to invest $6.7 billion in monopoly economy that continues to destroy these communities, or whether you go to distributed power.
Take that money, give it to, you know, wind farmers, solar manufacturers.
Methane capture. I mean, methane capture is a huge part of it, right? In addition to the energy efficiency, I mean, you can see huge job creation just on the weatherization efficiency stuff if you get the incentives right. So when you take the—
Okay. And you, and people get this, I presume, when you talk to them. But they don't get enough that they're going out and voting.
They did this time. I mean, the votes – nobody has turned out rural voters in a primary, no Democrat, in the way that we did this year. And the pipeline was and the anti-monopoly message was a huge motivating issue, and it was something that also played well with our coalition. So it helped that there was a conceptual piece here, the monopoly critique combined with a very localized issue that people could understand, that has, you know, the environment and the jobs component to it. It was a challenge with unions because some of the unions I happen to love were very pro-pipeline, and that continues to be a challenge. All of them agree. If we could change the dollars one for one over to clean energy, they would take that deal in a heartbeat because there are a lot more jobs created on the energy efficiency and clean energy. The problem is the monopoly gets to play by its own set of rules, Dominion Power. It's the biggest contributor to both political parties in Virginia, and it's just crushing job growth and business growth in Virginia. But everyone in the conventional wisdom, including the Washington Post, sort of buys into this argument that is completely at odds with the data in terms of where job creation and business creation comes from. So, you know, understanding this piece of the economy, the automation and consolidation piece together, which is really consolidation is two pieces, the monopoly and the geographic consolidation. But finding local examples obviously helps to draw this. But it's, you know, that along with the skyrocketing debt issues, I think Elizabeth Warren's really led the way on a lot of the living wage and debt issues, not just college debt but consumer debt, and what that means for people. Obviously, when the monopoly also comes into your Comcast, Verizon kind of experiences, it has a rural broadband piece, et cetera. Second, I think that, you know, we can talk more bluntly about both the criminal justice reform needs and the mental health needs in a way that the politics on this have changed. This is actually – first of all, it's the right thing to do, but it's actually a winning issue in rural communities if you talk about it right. Again, you have a little bit of a difference in the suburbs of how it lands. But you know, I think that's an important piece of it.
Two is fine. Don't worry.
I got more.
The first one was long. So
yeah, I felt that that was going to be the entirety.
I thought, I mean, yeah, that I would have voted. I mean, that and then convincing there.
Just before we go, just to address the idea of voter turnout and this notion that working mom, two jobs, literally cannot spend 45 minutes of her day to go to the polls. I mean, how do you communicate with her the significance of actually casting that ballot in a way that doesn't actually offend her, because she can't take off that time. She can't afford to take off that time.
Let me answer that in part by making it my third point.
Sure.
I can't remember the third one. And that was talking about a real democracy, rejuvenating democracy agenda. And in Virginia, we challenged the tech community to make Virginia the first 100% voter participation state. I think that combination of voter participation, nonpartisan redistricting, and money in politics, there's part of what makes someone not bother to vote is that they think the system is rigged and corrupt and they're right. So I'm even less likely to take those 45 minutes if I think that ultimately, you know, the districts have been drawn by a corporate lobbying firm in D.C., which they were, and, you know, there are all these efforts to limit, you know, voting, et cetera. We should be making it easier. I think we should go aggressive on that, get out of the voter suppression mode and into the 100% voting as the goal mode.
Which we've seen a lot of groups are now doing automatic registration as like their primary focus.
But Democrats, one of the mistakes we make is we focus on the policy, not the aspiration. All those are good things to do, automatic voting, et cetera. But when we talk about that, people's eyes glaze over. When you talk about the idea that we're going to reach 100% voter participation, people – that engages people, I think, in a different way. Let the policy wonks figure out how to get there, and it's important to have those policy ideas. But ultimately, what we need to be doing is setting the standard of what we're trying to get to, which I think – and then forcing the Republicans, quite frankly, to be against it. Why are you against 100% voter participation? So in those areas. In terms of – you know, we do this thing on the campaign called 24 Hours of Tom, where I campaign for 24 hours straight. So we did this – we actually did 7 a.m. to 8 a.m. So it was 25 hours of Tom this time. And you know, we stopped at this truck stop and I was talking to this woman who ended up being a Trump voter. And she's a single mom of three kids and she makes less than $10 an hour. And you know, her politics were in the other direction. And I said, you know, what would $15 an hour mean to you? That would be $28,000 a year. And she said, it would mean everything to me. It would mean my children's future. It would be a game changer. And she said, you know, that's the kind of thing – like she just didn't even know that was a possibility. But if she thought that a party was actually going to be fighting for that, she doesn't think the Democrats care about anyone other than rich people. I mean, you've seen the polling. Most Americans think Democrats only care about rich people. And so when we break through that in a meaningful way that connects to a kitchen table and she has the sense we're really going to fight for it, she then went on to say in the same conversation that she said, and it would really help to have the second income, but my fiance is in prison. And I said, what's he in prison for? And she said, he's in prison for being addicted to drugs. And you know, when we talked about the idea of treating addiction as a public health crisis, not only is there, you know, sort of the moral element of rehumanizing our relationship with people, it also means that family stays together and they're a two-income home and they're paying taxes instead of us paying $30,000 a year to incarcerate him. And I find conservative communities are very ready to hear the idea that instead of spending $300,000 a decade to incarcerate someone, you know, and I only want to spend $10,000 getting them a free community college education, who's the liberal and who's the conservative? To me, there's something pretty liberal about spending $300,000 of someone's taxpayer money to put someone in prison instead of $10,000 to invest in their education. So, you know, that's the kind of voter who just thinks of themselves as a Republican, thinks of the Democrats as the party of the elite, and sitting down and talking to about standing for those bolder things rather than this idea of trying to sound more like Republicans by going out and actually being a party of a bold economic agenda, I think we can get through to folks. But it's going to take multiple iterations and it's going to take politicians that are better than me at this.
So what's your future?
Are you going to run again?
Oh, I hope not. it's the fight that matters. And I think, you know, we have helped push the party to be much bolder. I think Ralph has is an even stronger candidate than he was before. And I think the first goal right now is to make sure we win big in Virginia and win big, frankly, on the issues that are now being mainstreamed in the party and show that those are good things to run on in a swing state, not just for the three statewides, but also for the House of Delegates that's in play. I'm going to be very involved in that as well. And I think it'll be an interesting chance to look at different people from different regions and areas and how they can run in this era of Trump. So that's a big part of it. And that'll be, you know, something like half of my life and then half is this Prevent a World War project, which is looking at both the racial reconciliation piece and the automation monopoly piece. And I think that's, you know, what that looks like.
Please prevent the world war.
I said one follow-up question.
Sure.
So you talk about, you know, meeting this woman at the truck stop and her needing to believe that you'll actually fight for her for this minimum wage increase, that a lot of people just don't believe Democrats when they say they'll fight for something, that they might chicken out or, you know, be sort of just saying something to get elected. And I think that was a criticism of Hillary, that like she would say some of these things and she kind of hedged on the minimum wage a little bit in the primary and she hedged on health care too. She said that – I mean there was at one point she was arguing against universal health care. So how do you combat that and how do you get Democrats to grow a spine?
Well, I would say it a little differently. I would say if you take Hillary's Senate run, when she was actually able to get out and meet people and they saw her as a human being, she was very effective at that. When it was filtered through the media, which I think was never particularly fair to her, I think it came across a different way. And I do think this issue, one of the things we took away from the campaign is unfiltered access to candidates is probably increasingly going to be the norm. I think that was why we were able to break through even though we weren't able to get across the finish line. And that's in part because people, frankly, are pretty cynical about the media. I mean, I don't know if this story is true, but apparently the journalist who was with us on 24 Hours of Tom took this story to the editors, and they were so skeptical because they thought it was staged, that he only included the wage piece and not the drug piece. And that's the thing. It's like, you know, so much of our experience was having one conversation outside the Beltway that was the lived experience, and then people here being like, oh, that can't possibly be true or right. But yes, I think, you know, people are looking for boldness. I go back to this idea. I don't think people feel right now that the system is effectively working for everyone. We just need to tweak it around the edges. I think the people are 10 steps ahead of the policymakers on understanding something has shifted tectonically. And, you know, if the Democratic Party is just against Trump, which is an important piece of it, I think we won't speak to that. If instead we're getting at these root causes of what is creating that level of economic anxiety and what – how do we address the, you know, the racial reconciliation piece, to me, those are going to be important elements.
Thanks, Tom.
Thank you.
That was former Congressman and gubernatorial candidate Tom Perriello. Candidate Confessional is produced and edited by Zach Young, who, as dedicated listeners will know by now, wrote our theme music. Are you happy, Zach?
Thank you, Sam.
He'll be selling CDRs of his theme song in the back of his pickup truck out front of the office.
Now, listen, if you enjoyed this show, please just continue to spread the word. I know it's over, but it's not going anywhere. We're still on iTunes. You can still pass around those links. As for season 3, the heart wants what it wants. And Jason, God damn it, we should do a season 3.
Sam, I want you to promise our listeners right here and now that we'll have a season 3.
I can't make that promise, but hopeful.
Stay tuned.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, Drew Scott here. And I'm Jonathan Scott, reminding you that life's better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. They can help you get just the right protection at just the right price and help you save when you bundle home and auto. Kind of like Goldilocks and the Three Bears. It'll be just right for you. We love a custom build. American Family Insurance. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.